This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
There is more or less a stalemate going on in the suburbs where there is fighting every day. And while on Monday, Haftar's forces did move forward, they were also on the same day moved back.
In Tripoli, that's VOA's Heather Murdoch on how General Khalifa Haftar's effort to take Libya's capital has bogged down. Details coming up. Also, rains are still pounding parts of northern Mozambique several days after Cyclone Kenneth made landfall. Tensions between Sudan's ruling military council and protesters have spiked, and the outbreak of the Ebola virus in the Democratic Republic of the Congo is getting worse. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Rains are still pounding parts of northern Mozambique several days after Cyclone Kenneth made landfall. The United Nations is saying aid workers face an incredible, difficult situation in reaching thousands of survivors. At least 41 people are reportedly dead so far. This is the first time two cyclones have struck the southern African nation in a single season. And Kenneth was the first cyclone recorded so far north in Mozambique in the modern era of satellite imaging. To brief us on the latest, we have in studio Anancio Miguel from the Portuguese to Africa service. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thank you very much.
How is Mozambique doing, and especially the city of Pemba?
Actually, as you said, there's still rain, but situation is improving these days. The number has been updated to 41 people over 30 were injured. And in terms of infrastructure, many houses were destroyed. We are talking here about at least 35,000 households had been destroyed in the whole province of Cabo Delgado. And we also saw that some of the islands, tourist destinations, were really very affected by the cyclone.
Lots of rain in Pemba. Is the government taking any steps to move Pemba residents to higher ground if the flooding continues?
Some have been moved to higher grounds, some went to stay in schools and some other places around town. The major areas of concerns are in remote areas like Makumia, like the islands of Ibu, Mutemu, where people, in spite of having all the warnings, they stayed in their house, and that's why they've been hit by the cyclone. And in the local news, the president, Philip Nyusi, is going to Makumia today to assess the situation and perhaps scale up the response to these people who have been affected by the floods.
Because they need food and shelter. That is a very hit area, Makumia and the Ibo Island.
Yeah, indeed. And one of the major problems was since it was raining heavily, it was very difficult to fly in that area. Only these days, aid agents are trying to reach the areas, but they can only reach the areas flying with helicopters because roads have been also very destroyed by the rain. So it's even difficult for aid agents to provide support in this region.
Anancio, is the government preparing for a possible cholera outbreak, because as wells could be contaminated and safe drinking water becomes a growing concern?
They are talking of scaling up efforts to avoid cholera and taking the experience that they had in central Mozambique in Beira, where they went on with a vaccination campaign. And also, not only with cholera, but also with polio, they are starting a campaign to vaccinate people against polio. Polio has been eradicated in Mozambique since the last five or so years, but this year we saw some other cases. So
it could come back. Anancio, do you have any numbers regarding buildings and homes partly or fully destroyed? Because there are reports that at least three bridges had collapsed, stranding a lot of the community.
And that number refers only to the major bridge. There are the small bridges that have been also destroyed. In terms of houses, the last number we have, like 35,000 houses destroyed in the whole province of Cabo Delgado. And these are houses belonging to poor people. Some of the reports that we get from Ibu Island, for example, many houses were destroyed as well as tourist destination, because the islands of Cabo Delgado were very attractive for tourists coming from all over the world. So this is going to have like an impact in the economics of the province too.
Yes, yes. Anancio Miguel from VOA's Portuguese to Africa Service, thank you for your input.
Thank you. See you next time.
Tensions between Sudan's ruling military council and protesters have spiked after the military warned it could remove barricades near their month-long sit-in. Protesters responded to fortifying obstacles around the protest camp and calling for a mass rally to pressure the military to hand over power to civilians. Naba Mohadin reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's main protest group, the Sudanese Professionals Association, has called for a mass rally to begin Thursday at 1 o'clock in the afternoon with the aim of fully achieving their demand for civilian rule. They made the call Wednesday, which is when they said the rally should take place Thursday at 1 p.m. When the Transitional Military Council said it would want it to remove protester barricades from bridges and roads and would not allow any more chaos in Sudan. Deputy Chief of the TMC, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, said it was their duty to safeguard citizens' property and the law. He said the barricades are paralyzing business in Khartoum and promoting criminal activity. We don't accept any chaos and attacking citizens and their property or state properties, says Dagalo. We will handle it with required closure and acting under the law, he says. Protesters at the main protest camp outside army headquarters responded by building some barricades even higher. Sitting in a chair behind a 1-meter-high fence made of stones and iron, protester Muhammad Taib is defiant. He says in the sitting securing committee, they have noticed some attempts to clear the demonstrations, but this latest threat has been met with more protesters and bigger barricades. Sudanese have been protesting by the thousands since December for a change in government. They have refused to end their sit-in demonstrations even after April 11, when the military ousted President Omar al-Bashir from 3 decades in power. On Tuesday evening, the protesters were joined by a large group of supporters from Sudan's war-torn Darfur region, including Motasim Ali. He says people should not trust the military council and that military leaders should hand over power to civilians as agreed. Sudan's protesters have reasons not to trust the military. It has yet to offer proof that Bashir is behind bars and has refused to turn him over to the International Criminal Court, which wants him for alleged war crimes in Darfur. The protesters and military last week agreed in principle to a power-sharing joint council, but failed to agree on which side would hold the majority of seats. On Wednesday, the African Union shortened the deadline for Sudan's military council to hand power to a civilian-led council from 3 months to 2. The AU initially gave the military a 2-week deadline to avoid suspension in the bloc, which it later extended. Naba Mohiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
In Libya, fighting continues around Tripoli as the forces of General Khalifa Haftar continue to try to capture the city from the Government of National Accord. Haftar's forces had controlled much of the country's east, but last month began a push into the capital where the United Nations-backed GNA is based. The offensive began just weeks before the UN planned to hold a national conference to find a way forward for the country. VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch is in Tripoli, covering the fighting. A few hours ago, she spoke from the front lines with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson about what she is seeing.
I'm here about less than 100 meters from the front line, where soldiers from the western Libya government of national accord are fighting with the soldiers of Khalifa Haftar, who about 3 weeks ago announced he was planning on taking over Tripoli. Since he came here a little more than 3 weeks ago, he has not gotten into the city, but there is more or less a stalemate going on in the suburbs where there is fighting every day. And while on Monday, Haftar's forces did move forward, they were also on the same day moved back. Since then, they have pretty much maintained the line, but there has been fighting every evening, along with airstrikes every evening. The displaced, there are about 42,000 people have been displaced from this conflict, but recently, soldiers say that people are not coming out of the conflict because the people who are still there, after all this time, really have no place to go. I can see ambulances coming out of the war zone and some cars coming in. And just a few minutes ago, there was pretty heavy fire, but it seems to have quieted down for the moment.
Is any aid getting in to both areas where there's combat and then just to the city in general? Medical aid, food supplies, those sorts of things?
There is some aid going to makeshift refugee camps or displacement camps and schools. But a lot of it is not international aid, it's local aid. And one of the things the aid workers here complain about is that they get international aid, but it's often not what they need. Like, they'll get tents, but they don't need tents in the city of Tripoli. They have plenty of shelter. They need extra food and, you know, and funds to supply electricity and water.
So far, what are the GNA troops telling you about their experience, what they have seen as they fought?
Their experience so far is they're surprised at how brutal this fight has been. They say that Haftar's forces are bringing heavy weapons into the city, and some of it I've even seen. On Saturday night, there were airstrikes right in the city, and there were huge drones flying overhead. They say that the fighting is pretty brutal, and they're pretty scared for the civilians on both sides of the front line.
That was VOA's Heather Murdoch reporting from the front lines in Tripoli. The outbreak of the Ebola virus in the Democratic Republic of the Congo has worsened in recent weeks. Days ago, officials reported the highest number of new cases in a 24-hour period. 26 people were reported to have died in North Kivu province on Sunday. The World Health Organization has confirmed nearly 900 deaths from the disease since the outbreak started last year. Adding to the serious situation is violence against health workers fighting the disease. A doctor from Cameroon was fatally shot last month and two others seriously injured. Another center was set on fire. Healthcare workers are threatening to go on strike if the security situation does not improve. Dr. Michael Yao is the head of WHO operations in the DRC. My colleague Mario Ritter Jr. spoke with Dr. Yao earlier about why the number of cases in the eastern DRC has jumped so quickly and why so many infections are fatal.
The number of Ebola cases is rising sharply for different reasons. One of the reasons is actually access to the community. This helps, in fact, to detect cases earlier and to give treatment opportunities and as well as stop transmission within a given household. The other elements that we cannot do due to difficult access is vaccination. Contact of positive cases are vaccinated, and this prevents further spread. Some of the interventions are related to decontamination of health facilities as well as households that experience positive cases. We face quite a number of community deaths, people hiding and also escaping from the contact follow-up and dying in the community while also spreading the disease around in the different families. So all these different factors make it difficult to address, but also conducive to a sharp increase in numbers.
Not only has the number of cases increased, some observers note that the percentage of deaths appear to be increasing. That means more of those who are infected are dying. Is this the case, and if so, why do you think?
We have a number of deaths, but most of them are actually community deaths. If we compare this outbreak to the one that occurs in West Africa, we are slightly lower in terms of number of people dying in the health facilities. But one of the main factors related to death, of course, is people not seeking health service and dying within the community or coming late to the treatment center. It's a disease that evolves faster. So if you come at the earlier stage, higher is the chance to be treated and survive. But if you arrive quite late, it's made quite impossible to save the patient. So this has been the critical issues.
The WHO reports that only half of the funds needed to continue its operations have been provided. How are the needed funds going to be secured?
For us to actually finish the job is quite essential to mobilize the remaining resources for us to ensure that vaccine is available on site, to ensure that we have the required vehicles to move into different communities, Ebola being a kind of a case-by-case management that require that you move far away into the community to deal with.
And finally, there have been reports that healthcare workers will go on strike if the security situation does not improve. One physician has already been killed. What is being done to improve security for workers in the DRC?
Since the killing of one of our colleagues, we are working closely with the national authorities as well as with the peacekeeping force. So we are working with all the different stakeholders, security-wise, to ensure that at least the team that move out are protected. We are also readjusting our strategies, like for vaccination, ensuring that we move into a safer place. Our objective is to strengthen and to make sure that all our team that goes out, they are fully protected.
That was VOA's Mario Richard Jr. speaking with Dr. Michael Yao, the head of WHO operations in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in Goma. Several online surveys show voters are set to return South Africa's African National Congress, or ANC, to power when the country goes to the polls on May 8th. This despite the legacy of former ANC President Jacob Zuma, who's accused of numerous counts of corruption and the party's poor governance in recent times. In the build-up to the vote, Zuma's replacement, Cyril Ramaphosa, has faced several potentially damaging allegations as his opponents battle to prevent the ANC from winning with a large majority. Darren Taylor reports about some of the allegations.
One of South Africa's most respected former liberation fighters, Terra Lakota, now a member of parliament, was among the first to publicly say what's long been whispered, that President Cyril Ramaphosa, who led mine workers in their rebellion against apartheid in the 1980s, was a spy for the white supremacist regime.
You condemned us to the special branch. And I say, no, I say this to you. I say this to you.
Order.
Because the special branch rewarded you and they sent you home. And we headed to Robben Island. You made your choice then.
There's a point of order, and Honorable Lakota.
The white government imprisoned Lakota on the barren island off the coast of Cape Town, together with his fellow anti-apartheid activists, including Nelson Mandela, for 8 years. Lakota now leads a small opposition party called the Congress of the People. In Parliament, Ramaphosa denied the allegations and warned Lakota that his allegation was extremely dangerous. The president says he was detained with Lakota in Pretoria in 1974, when Ramaphosa was 21, for organizing a student protest. He says the police beat him, trying to get him to turn state witness against Lakota and the others, but he shouted defiantly at them.
I will never betray the comrades that I was working with. And if I did, where will I go and live thereafter? I refused.
Ramaphosa says the police continued to torture him, but he never buckled. He says someone else provided the testimony that ultimately condemned Lokota to the country's infamous Robben Island prison. After the activists were sentenced, says Ramaphosa, the police released him without charge. Ramaphosa says his suffering at the hands of the police continued, including when he was jailed after the Soweto uprising of 1976.
They said, you're going to be like Nelson Mandela, you're going to break rocks on Robben Island. I said, I would rather go and break rocks. I will never, ever betray my people.
After another 6 months in detention, he says, the police again released him. Later, he helped establish the National Union of Mine Workers, or NUM, to fight for labor rights and to oppose racism. Other Ramaphosa opponents point to another rumored allegation that Ramaphosa's union was sponsored by the multinational mining company, Anglo American. The liberation movement detested the firm, saying it collaborated with the apartheid authorities so it could access South Africa's mineral wealth. Ramaphosa says it would not have made sense for Anglo American to back the union because its members' strikes damaged the company. He also asks, if his union was a tool of apartheid, why did it endorse and follow the ANC's Human Rights Declaration?
The NUM was the first union to adopt the Freedom Charter in our country. The very first union. And following that, the NUM was the biggest motivator for the formation of COSATU.
COSATU is the Congress of South African Trade Unions, which became one of the most effective weapons against the white nationalist government. Ramaphosa says the allegations that he was an apartheid collaborator are designed to damage him and the ANC before the election. Some political analysts say the spy accusations actually may have boosted Ramaphosa because they've given the wealthy entrepreneur an opportunity to remind citizens of his credentials as a patriot and a defender of human rights. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of African News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Misha Dubinsky, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa. The Voice of America's Straight Talk Africa puts you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they talk about the most important social and political issues that affect you. Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.